You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont author Tovar Cerulli, whose book, The Mindful Carnivore, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance, was published by Pegasus Books in February. Tovar Cerulli has been wondering about humans and other animals since he was a boy. He grew up in Vermont and New Hampshire, where he spent long summer days outdoors, exploring and swimming, gathering wild blueberries for breakfast, and reeling in brook trout for dinner. After college at Dartmouth in Japan and at the New School in Manhattan, he headed back to nature, where his education had begun. He worked for several years as a carpenter, and then, having handled umpteen thousand board feet of lumber and having burned dozens of cords of firewood, he bought a chainsaw and took his ecological values for an enlightening walk in the woods, apprenticing with a forester logger. A few years later, having returned to omnivory after a decade as a vegetarian, he decided to take his dietary ethics for a walk in the woods, too, deer rifle in hand. Tovar has written on hunting, forestry, wildlife, and conservation for Outdoor America, Northern Woodlands, and Massachusetts Wildlife, among others. He received his BA from Eugene Lang College of the New School for Social Research. In 2009, he was awarded a graduate school fellowship by the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he studies communication. His master's thesis, Meat and Meanings, Adult Onset Hunters, Cultural Discourses of the Hunt, was completed in 2011. He is currently enrolled at UMass as a PhD student and continues to focus his research on food, hunting, and human relationships with the natural world. Tovar Cerulli lives in Vermont with his wife, Catherine, their affectionate Labrador retriever, Kaya, and an eclectic mix of cookbooks. When I spoke to him last week, I asked him to start by talking about his interpretation of the word mindful in his book's title.
When I use the word mindful in connection with food, what I have in mind, so to speak, is an awareness of where our food comes from, an awareness of the impacts it has, just an attention to that, and also a sense of indebtedness and gratitude to the natural world and the people who bring our food to us.
Mm-hmm.
Comes out of a sense of both, you know, Buddhist meditation, which I've done a bit of and paid attention to some of those teachings, but more broadly, just to a being awake and aware and present.
Right, right. Okay. I enjoyed in the book, you know, there's a large section at the beginning where you talk about how you used to fish as a child, and you had a very close friend who acted as a sort of fishing mentor to you, Willie. I was wondering if you can talk about the experience of fishing when you were young and how that might have affected the person you became when you grew up.
Being out with Willie, especially on the water and near the water, was a wonderful experience for me as a kid. Both the engagement with the natural world and the sort of quiet attentiveness that many anglers experience, you know, to water and to the breeze and fish and insects and so on. But also the connection to Willie as a person. He was, you know, a great mentor and a very grounded sort of person who, mm-hmm. who really was able to, guide me in a very gentle way and just be there with me as a more knowledgeable sort of figure. And I think that that time affected both my sensibilities about the natural world and the possibilities for enjoying time out there, which I did in lots of other ways as a kid as well. I think it also gave me a sense of the potential for companionable experiences out of doors, even if you're sitting in silence. Mm-hmm. Something that I can continue to appreciate now, whether it's with my wife or with a hunting companion. So yeah, I think it set the stage in some ways for both of those aspects.
Now, when you were young and you were fishing, were other members of your family at all conflicted about the practice of eating fish and eating meat? Or I know your father didn't care for fish, or he didn't care to fish. That's what in the book you said, he didn't care to fish.
Yeah, nobody in my family brought up any particular issues about food ethics, whether it was meat or fish. And also, no one in my immediate family, and here I'm talking, you know, my parents and my sisters, was terribly interested in fishing either.
Right.
They were completely fine with me doing it, but just didn't have much interest in spending time doing it. I had the one uncle who plays a role in the book who was very actively involved in fishing and hunting, but he lived several hours away. So, yeah, no one in my immediate family was either involved or had much of a problem with it.
Okay. And then eventually you started noticing, I think as kids we're a little bit clueless about our effect on the world around us, and so you talk in the book about having, you know, just fishing was part of what you did, but you weren't thinking about killing a live creature necessarily all those times when you were really little. But as you became older, you did start to notice and have thoughts about this. How old were you when you became a vegetarian?
I was 20.
Okay.
I had started to get exposed to vegetarian cuisine in my late teens. My girlfriend at the time, her entire family was vegetarian, and I had meals there, and they were great. I just started to get exposed to that food and to some of the ideas and questions around it. But it was when I was 20 and actually had that very particular experience with one fish that I described in the opening pages of the book, that I made the decision to become vegetarian.
Right. Okay. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a paragraph from the book that I thought touched on a really interesting point. Is that okay with you if I read a paragraph?
Please do.
All right. Great. Vegetarianism and soon thereafter veganism became more than a mere diet. Though secular, it became a way of life, a statement of values and identity, a coat of arms for the struggle to right all that was wrong with the world. It started out being about food, but soon the beliefs themselves began to sustain me. I felt sure that everyone should be vegetarian. My zealous certainty should have set off warning bells, but it didn't. I hadn't yet figured out that religious fundamentalism isn't the only dangerous kind. I thought that was a really great paragraph and really interesting idea.
You know, I know vegetarians who don't carry that particular brand of zealotry along with their diet. I did, and I know many who did or do. And it's interesting to look back, as I do in the book, historically at American vegetarianism in particular, where that level of zeal, and often in a religious context, especially back in the 1800s, really was quite present, less to do with animal welfare at the time and more to do with other kinds of some religious issues. And I find that kind of, you know, I use the term fundamentalism there, that kind of rigid black and white view tends to narrow possibilities for conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Though I wasn't a vegetarian proselytizer. I didn't actually go out and try to convert people particularly. I did have that sort of rigid sense and didn't have much room for conversation about it in my own mind at the time.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think, too, that you were very young when you became a vegetarian. And I think the things that we discover when we're very young and take on as our own personal philosophies, you know, we're so ardent at that point. You know, it's very exciting to learn who you're going to be. So, I mean, to some extent, it probably just had to do with making decisions and choices for yourself at that point in your life.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that that's often the case with our youthful enthusiasms and youthful revelations do sometimes become more fixed or more powerful than things that we realize later in life and perhaps have some greater context or nuance for. I was interested, I mentioned this in the notes at the end of the book, that there's a passage in the Dalai Lama's autobiography where he talks about when he was vegetarian and how he got a certain kind of satisfaction, I think is the word he uses, maybe wrong about that, from the strict interpretation of the rule. Mm-hmm. There's something about the strictness and the rule itself that became an end in itself, which I found interesting. That resonated for me in my experience.
Yeah, yeah. When you were a vegetarian, you were a gardener. You got married, and you and your wife had gardens, and you would grow vegetables. And part of the transition into thinking in new ways about mindful eating had to do with guarding your vegetable garden from insects and hungry little animals. I loved the section in the book. You have this very amusing anecdote about a woodchuck that was infiltrating your garden. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that period of time when you were coming to grips with the fact that, in fact, these animals were going for the food, and if you wanted the food, you were going to have to figure out how to deal with these animals.
Yeah, you know, that particular encounter that you're mentioning was, you know, in the real heart of my vegetarian and vegan years, and this, you know, woodchuck was coming and helping himself to our first garden, and, you know, I tried chasing him away, and it really didn't work at all. he basically called my bluff, you know, and turned on me in the middle of the lawn and basically wondered what I was going to do, and of course I wasn't going to do anything. So that never worked out very well for me. Later, when we had a fence garden and were fairly confident that we could keep out woodchucks, deer, rabbits, that sort of thing, I was still dealing with, as you mentioned, you know, insects. There were beetles of various kinds that were decimating various vegetables. And I realized that I had to repel or poison or kill them in some way. That was a little uncomfortable. You know, the strict veganism code typically goes as far as prohibiting honey because of bees. Doesn't typically recognize that bees are used and abused in producing all kinds of vegetables, fruits, almonds,
right.
etc.
Right.
They are, but the actual product of honey from bees is a matter of concern for some vegans. I also had started to recognize that the vegetables that I was getting, the grains I was getting from the store, were quite closely tied not only to displacement of habitat in the first place, destruction of either forest or prairie or some other kind of habitat to create crop fields, but also the ongoing killing of all kinds of critters, insects, birds, small mammals, large mammals, and that was quite sobering to realize that even a couple miles down the road at the local organic farm, you know, woodchuck and deer were being killed to keep, you know, organic greens and organic strawberries and whatnot in our refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Eventually, when woodchucks proved that our fence was not going to stop them, even if it was 7 feet tall and buried underground, then I had to confront, you know, do I actually kill a woodchuck, or do I let the organic farmer down the road kill the woodchuck for me?
Right, exactly. So that's a tough one.
Yeah, and then that was one of the sort of first and more uncomfortable steps in dealing with, you know, issues around my own food, even if I was still a vegetarian.
Yeah, right. But it is such an interesting path from that very enthusiastic 20-year-old who sees his cause through, you know, passionate eyes, and then this person who has to discover that, in fact, you know, this is more complicated. The line from the book that struck me as summing up a lot of what you were feeling as you made your way, you know, from one philosophy to another, I thought this was great. It was not so much what we ate that mattered, tofu or trout, chard or chicken, as how that food came to our plates. Obviously, that's after you've made the decision to go ahead and introduce some new protein into your diet, because you were advised by a physician that you wanted to have better protein. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why is tofu not adequate to meet the protein needs of most people?
You know, I'm not a nutritionist.
Okay.
And, I mean, soy, from the many things I've read over the past, you know, 10 or 15 years, soy is problematic for people's health, generally speaking, in a number of ways. I think that most people can do quite well on a diet that has a lot of plants in it.
Right.
And that has some animal protein, you know, some eggs, some dairy, something, you know, mm-hmm. some fish, some kind of animal protein source. And it's not just protein, you know, it's vitamin B12 and certain kinds of fatty acids and these sorts of things. Protein is the sort of broad term that gets bandied around a lot, and I use it too, but I think that's somewhat misleading, because there's lots of sort of micronutrients that are perhaps at least as much the issue. And some people seem to do pretty well on a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. I think that in the long term, 10, 20 plus years, I think that fewer people do really well on a strict vegan diet. And you have to be really careful and conscientious of trying to supplement, you know, having vitamin B12 supplements and so on, to be able to do that in even a marginally sustainable way, I think, for your health. But people are different. I mean, people seem to do better on some kinds of diets where other people do better on others. Right. So I don't have any sort of mission to make everyone an omnivore.
No.
Or anything like that. And I found that for me, after about 10 years as a vegan, you know, my energy was low, my immune system wasn't really up to snuff, and it seemed to really make a difference for me to start adding some animal protein back into my diet.
I want to just back up a second and say, you know, when you were saying you're not trying to convince everybody to be omnivores, it's really clear in the book that this entire project of writing this book is an extended meditation on just how important all of these decisions were for you personally, and it's not at all a sales pitch. So it was a much better book for that. You know, I mean, it's not trying to sell any point of view.
One of the early reviews that was posted online was written by a vegetarian, a Buddhist, and she had some very complimentary things to say about the book, and one thing that she mentioned was that the book actually made her think about going back to being a vegan.
Hmm.
Really thinking about the impacts of the dairy industry, for example, on animals and, mm-hmm. and so on. And she also wrote that she thought that the author would consider it a compliment to know that that's what the book inspired her to think about.
Yeah, right.
And she was right. It was great. You know, she understood the book. She understood the questions I was asking in both the sort of historical and cultural overviews that I offer and also my personal experience. And she leaned toward heading back toward veganism. Well, yeah, good for her.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no objection, and I did consider it a compliment.
I wonder, I suspect the subject matter in the book, even though you're not, as I said, you know, trying to make everybody an omnivore, but I do suspect that the subject matter might attract strong opinions on both sides. And I'm wondering if you've heard a lot from readers of the book, a lot of reactions on either side.
You know, interestingly, I've had really positive reactions from vegetarians and really positive reactions from hunters.
Oh, good.
And really positive reactions from, you know, non-hunting omnivores in the middle.
Yeah.
So, you know, there have been some critiques. There was one vegan who wrote a very detailed review and critiqued some of my arguments and some of my actions, and which is always the trick with a memoir, you know. Your writing can be addressed in one sentence, like, you know, it's really well written, and then they go on to, you know, critique your life.
Great.
There's always the danger in writing something that is memoir based, even if it's not just straight personal memoir.
Right.
But no, it's been very, very positive overall, and the only strongly negative reactions that I've received are people who have not read the book.
Oh,
people
interesting.
You just see a mention online, and there's sort of a... And I can understand it, because I probably would have had a similar feeling, you know, 20 years ago. Just a horror that here's this person who was supposedly this compassionate vegan, and they've turned out to be this sort of murderous monster. And they're a traitor to the cause and so on, you know, but they haven't actually read the book. It's just the idea that someone went back to being an omnivore and actually took up hunting and had a firsthand involvement in getting flesh food that sort of is a flashpoint for some people.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't take that too seriously, because those who have actually read the book, overall have been very positive, even if they live in a different way and wouldn't do the same things that I've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, at a certain point, as we've already mentioned, you did decide to get a hunting license. And in the process of getting a hunting license, you took a hunting and gun safety course. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the experience of that class and also maybe mention a few examples of things that you learned in the course to avoid accidents, some of the important things.
The state hunter education or hunter safety courses that are offered and required in most, if not all, states really originated around the issue of safety.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in the 1950s, they started up, which is sort of when hunting was at its peak in terms of participation in America. And the experience for me, one interesting aspect of it was just a kind of culture shock, because I had, you know, lived among friends and acquaintances who had nothing to do with hunting and generally had not much good to say about hunting. And then to, you know, walk into this, you know, fish and game club where there are, you know, taxidermied animals on all the walls and, you know, guys with NRA t-shirts, and it was just a completely different culture.
Yeah.
for me to walk into, and in that world, hunting is, you know, viewed as entirely positive in both as personal experience and as wildlife management and a number of other ways. That was just culturally interesting to sort of make that transition, not from one to the other, but into that sort of no man's land between the two and get some perspective on both. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, the learning in the class, though there are other things talked about and taught in the class, safety is central, and it, you know, is around handling of firearms, around the choice to shoot and being absolutely sure that there's no possibility of a projectile, particularly a bullet, going further than you intend and or coming anywhere near a human, and then also the focus on making sure that it's a very precise and quick kill, that the animal doesn't suffer. Yeah, there are lots of things in terms of safety. Just being aware, for example, that when you look through a rifle scope, if you have a scope on a rifle, or a shotgun for that matter, that you don't actually see what's close to you and below the line of sight of the scope, but might be in front of a barrel. They gave examples, you know, not only of horrible tragedies, but also simply, you know, someone leaning across the hood of their truck or car and, you know, tearing a big tunnel through the hood of their car with a bullet because they didn't realize that you're looking through the scope and they're not seeing where the actual point, the actual muzzle of the rifle is aimed. Just simple things like that, that if you're new to it, you wouldn't think about, wouldn't realize that sort of thing can happen.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I found reassuring that they are very focused on is the idea of having a sure backstop. Is that the right word? You just absolutely know that if you miss, then your bullet will hit something other than a person.
That's right. And they gave examples. I mean, we had we had an incident here in Vermont. I believe it was 2001, where that's exactly what happened. A hunter fired at a deer, and there was not a solid backstop, and it went, you know, across fields. It went like half a mile and went into, you know, somebody's, I think, a small home or maybe a trailer and killed a guy, mm-hmm. Which I mentioned in the book. So, yes, it's critical when you're using a long-range weapon like a rifle, where the bullet can literally go for miles, that it's, you know, there's either dense forest or a hill or something, you know, on the other side of that animal, so that it can't just go somewhere unknown.
Mm-hmm. In your reading, you mentioned the hunter who had set up salt block bait, and there's another part in the book where somebody has killed a deer and has left the site of the kill trashed. And your reactions to these treatments of hunting were, I thought, very good examples of your feelings regarding hunting animals, but at the same time showing respect for them, showing gratitude for the food that hunting will yield. So I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about that. I know that in the book you talk about saying a little prayer of thanks when you take a life.
You know, just briefly, I'll mention the baiting issue. That is something that I still have sort of conflicted thoughts about, and there's a whole ongoing conversation for, you know, generations out there among hunters about so-called fair chase and whether baiting should be allowed or shouldn't, and does it make it, you know, less hunting and more just sort of shooting, and is it less so-called sporting? There's a whole big conversation around that, and there are lots of interesting perspectives on it. But the more disturbing one for me, really, that you mentioned, where this place where a deer had been killed, and the hunter had left trash, left, you know, field dressing gloves, plastic trash in the woods. That I found deeply disturbing, and still really do. And for me, as I describe in the book, there's a sense of something powerful has happened in this place. You know, the deliberate choice to end a life, has been made here. And that is something that I consider deeply serious, and to essentially desecrate that by leaving trash and exhibiting disrespect, I find really sort of repulsive. And every hunter that I respect does too. They really find that inexcusable behavior.
Right. It seems almost like the hunter, there is no one hunter. You know, there are the hunters that are hunting for sustenance, respectful of the creatures, you know, very thoughtful, you know, and then there's also the hunting parties that, and probably they're also eating the meat, but, you know, it's more of a party, it's more of a sport. Drinking, I think, probably is a big part of some of the hunting parties, and I would think that's sort of problematic.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to draw a hard and fast line between sort of types of hunters, because there's so much variation across the spectrum. People's attitudes, people's behaviors, their values, the language they use, you know, the language of sport, for example. I personally don't like it and don't use it, but I understand where it comes from. You know, it's an ancient concept, coming out of the Middle East and the ancient Greeks, coming through the Middle Ages in Europe, and I understand it. I just don't like it personally, and I think in the modern context it evokes way too many weird connotations, the notion of sport, to be helpful in talking about what the hunting experience is like, at least for me.
Okay.
But that said, I do think that there are these, you know, these ranges of types of hunting attitudes and behaviors, and there unquestionably is a certain, you know, set of hunters and hunter behaviors that are really disturbing to a lot of hunters and to non-hunters, not just around safety, but around how animals are treated, how careful hunters are with you know, not causing undue suffering, and how they respect a scene like the place where an animal has been killed. And that, I think, is actually a broader reflection of our culture. It's not as though we have, you know, these horrible hunters who sort of come out of the blue. You know, we have an entire culture that operates with not a whole lot of regard for nature and for animals. Some of that's, you know, intentional, and some of it's just unintentional. We, you know, spray chemicals, and we build shopping malls, and we do this and do that. We don't, you know, we're not out to hurt animals per se, but we do all kinds of things that are grossly harmful. Agricultural practices are included in that. You know, some of our agricultural practices are really horrendous. And that broader cultural pattern is reflected in the most negative, sort of the darkest hunter behavior that we find. And it becomes, I think of it as sort of a lightning rod, because it's visible whenever it, you know, is seen or in the news, and it's voluntary, very specifically, you know, willful behavior that is quite disturbing to us, and I think it should be. I think it's just helpful to see it as the dark side of something much larger that I think arguably needs reform on a larger scale in terms of our attitudes toward animals and nature.
Mm-hmm. The class that you took, it sounded like the instructor was very aware of being not only just being careful with your weapon, but also having respect for what you're doing and for the importance of hunting and how dangerous it is and everything else. Do you think that that's a message that some of, I mean, it sounds like there were a lot of kids in that class. Do you think that's a message that a lot of them took home with them?
You know, state hunter education courses average about 13 hours. And here you have 12 and 13-year-old kids who, for 12 or 13 years, have been probably, in most cases, growing up in a family where hunting is practiced. Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, by father or uncle, maybe by a mother or an aunt. And so my sense is that the values and the practices of hunters are primarily transmitted from family members and maybe from friends. That's where we do most of our learning. You know, I did most of my learning from my uncle, and from my own thinking and reading and reflecting, but he was a good mentor for me and one that I felt good about. But, you know, does 13 hours of class have a huge impact on a hunter in the long run? I don't know. I mean, I hope that, you know, both the safety instruction and also some of the talk about the seriousness of hunting and the ethics of it, I hope that those stick. My hunch is that if the family is already transmitting those sorts of ideas and those sorts of values, then they probably stick better.
Yeah.
Than if in the minority, I think, you know, maybe they aren't encouraging that kind of thinking. I doubt it sticks as much.
Okay, so maybe this would be a good time for you to read a little bit from the book, Tovar.
Sure, I'd be happy to. What I thought I would read is a couple of pages from the second half of the book, actually, when I've just started to move into being a hunter after much conflicted thought and exploration philosophically of it. I've finally actually gone out to start hunting.
Okay. And,
so this is from chapter 10, which is called Into the Woods. My first hours in the October woods were peaceful. I sat on a rock near an old logging road, watching. The recurve bow that Jay had sent me lay across my lap. A red squirrel, apparently unaware of me, scampered by within a few feet. Another day, I perched in my tree stand, not far from where I had recently seen a pair of deer. It was a gray dawn, damp and misty. Chickadees alit close by. A chipmunk bounded through leaves and ferns. I felt no need to do anything but listen and watch, bow in hand. No need even to think. As Zen teachers say, just sit. In moments of delusion, I found myself assuming that a deer would soon appear and thinking through the steps I would take to properly care for the meat. In other moments, I realized how unlikely that was. As a novice, I had only just begun to learn and felt relief. I wasn't sure how it would feel to kill a deer. Nor was I sure I was ready to find out. Killing the hare 9 months earlier had been unsettling, and I imagined that taking a deer would hit me harder. It might be better to focus on more modest goals that autumn. Just get out in the woods, spend some time with Uncle Mark, settle into the idea, start getting a sense of what it would mean to be a hunter. Partly, it would mean quiet reverie, watchfulness, and learning to navigate the woods. Partly, it would mean learning to navigate more complicated human terrain. Hiking home one Saturday afternoon, I detoured to check for deer sign along the back edge of an overgrown beaver meadow. When I got to the spot, the trees sparse, the long grasses bent over by the repeated passage of whitetails headed down to the water's edge, I found a tree stand set up near illegal bait, two blocks of salt. And the hunter had gone further. While it's common enough for hunters to nip off a few small branches here and there to allow a clear shot, this one had carried in a chainsaw and felled a 6-inch diameter balsam fir, leaving a wide open shooting lane between tree stand and salt. The landowners, I imagined, might object to that much disturbance. I hoped the deer would, too, steering clear of the bait and denying the hunter any ill-won gains. I left a phone message for the local game warden. Even if the hunter wasn't caught in the act of hunting over salt, he would get a warning letter in the mail. Finding him would be easy enough, for he had obeyed the law in one respect, by prominently displaying his name on the tree stand. Headed home the next morning, after two more quiet hours in the woods, I saw a neighbor coming down the rail bed trail, out for a walk with his young golden retriever. I winced. I felt certain that he, like most of my friends and acquaintances, wasn't keen on hunting. Given my own long-time opposition to the killing of animals for food, let alone for sport, I could hardly blame him. In his eyes, I would be one of them. As he drew near, I could see surprise on his face. "It is you," he said, taking in my camouflaged clothing and bow. I thought, "It's some redneck out hunting. I need to watch my back." But no, it's you out hunting, and I need to watch my back. We had a polite, if awkward, chat and parted ways. Walking home, I considered the encounter. Though I knew I posed no danger to my neighbor or his dog, it didn't surprise me to hear his safety concerns. Nor did his phrase, "some redneck out hunting," shock me. He was merely articulating the stereotype of the hunter as an ignorant backwoods rube, a common view rooted in the kind of tree-felling, law-breaking behavior I had come across the day before, and also in centuries of history.
Great. Thank you very much for reading that. I'll just mention that's Tovar Cerulli reading from The Mindful Carnivore, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance, which is published by Pegasus Books. That's a great section. I really enjoyed the sections where you are in the woods, partly because after you decided to try to hunt for a deer, it took a while before anything happened, and so you have a lot of quiet solitude in the woods, which seems like a perfect time to think about this step you're taking. I enjoyed the reflection that you make in the book that it was very important to still your mind and not try too hard while you were waiting for a deer to show up.
Yeah, you know, in my first year especially of deer hunting, I was really perfectly happy not to get a deer. I wasn't sure I was ready for that experience, as I suggested at the beginning of that passage. And so that was just an experience of sort of patient, you know, watchfulness and curiosity. After a few years, when I started to wonder what I was doing out there and whether there was any point to this exercise, after, you know, 2-3 years of not succeeding as a hunter in terms of actually getting a deer, then I began to realize that the stilling of the mind was important for me in terms of having a positive experience out there and enjoying being out there without that kind of striving.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to let it be a meditative experience and have it be a enjoyable experience, I needed to do that. Lastly, I started to wonder a bit, and this gets into a little bit more metaphysical territory. I started to wonder if my mental state had anything to do with my potential success or lack thereof.
Uh-huh.
And that's not a question I've ever entirely answered for myself, but I did start to wonder about that, both from my own experiences and also from some things that my uncle told me about his experiences in the woods, that maybe the sort of the vibe that we send out, for lack of a better term, affects what happens out there, and I don't know.
Right, yeah. No, it was really interesting to read those sections because I've never really thought about that, you know, but I'm sure the animals react to what they sense as danger, and any sort of anxiety on the part of the hunter probably comes across in some way. I mean, animals pick up on so much that we don't have the senses to understand necessarily. Tovar, I wanted to ask how the book began for you. Were you originally just sort of writing a journal that turned into a book, or were you always writing a book in your own mind?
The idea for the book first occurred to me about 4 years ago, after I had written a magazine article, an essay, about this same journey, in, you know, just a couple thousand words, having grown up as an omnivore, becoming a strict vegetarian, and then eventually becoming a hunter. And as I sat there looking at this article published in this magazine, this crazy little idea crept into the back of my head that I could write a book based on this. And, you know, it, of course, is much more complicated than that. hey, I'll write that longer. It doesn't work that way.
Right. I'll add 15 pages for every paragraph.
Exactly. It's like, well, that was 3,000 words. If I multiply that by 20, I'm good.
Right, exactly.
Not how it works. So that was the beginning of the actual book idea. What I will mention, too, is that I had been keeping a very active correspondence by email with my uncle Mark, who lives on Cape Cod, who was my mentor in getting into this in many ways. And I had that email correspondence as sort of a repository of my experiences. And for whatever reason, both the default saving, but also actively saving those emails in a particular folder of correspondence with him, I had that to refer to. So it was kind of like a journal. I would send him emails about my experiences in the woods or my thoughts. It wasn't by any means a simple, you know, matter of taking that and turning it into book chapters, but I had a sort of a journal resource in that as well.
I'm wondering if you're writing anything now. Are you working on something new?
Well, I'm both working on, you know, the promotion of this book, getting the word out since it just came out a few weeks ago, and I'm also enrolled full-time as a graduate student. So I'm doing a PhD program down at UMass Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
And my research is related, you know, to hunting and food and people's relationships to land and place. And my master's thesis was also, which I was actually writing simultaneous with the book. I was writing my master's thesis at the same time. And so I'm right now not working on any, you know, book scale trade publication project. Most of my writing, carving out some time for some blog posts, and then working on my schoolwork at the moment.
Okay, all right. I have one more question for you. For writers, I'm wondering if you can offer any advice. Many of the scenes in The Mindful Carnivore take place outdoors, such as the one that you read earlier, in the woods or in the garden. So I'm wondering for writers if you can offer any advice for writing about the natural world.
I think that, you know, writing style is a very personal thing. For me, it was really important to attend to details that were, you know, relevant to the mood for the direction of that particular scene. And I think that that's something that is almost always helpful for writers, you know, both in the natural world and in other scenes, is attention to that kind of detail. The one thing that I'll also mention is that one of my writing instructors several years back, who was teaching a workshop at a writing retreat relative to the outdoors, to nature in particular, warned us against, which was something that he called moon talk. Getting a little bit too flowery and descriptive and wildly poetic. Not that he was saying, you know, you shouldn't have any of those elements in your writing, but rather that we can drift off into sort of ethereal nature talk in our writing, and we need to bring it back to, you know, back down to earth, so to speak, but also back to people, because that's what other people are interested in.
I love that moon talk. That's really funny. I remember when I was getting my MFA, there was a poet in the program who used to talk about how, you know, no one should ever write about the moon. It's just, so I wonder if that's from the same root of moon talk.
It could be.
All right. Well, Tovar, it was a pleasure speaking with you. I really enjoyed reading your book, The Mindful Carnivore, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance. Tovar Cerulli, thank you for speaking with me today.
It's been great fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tovar Cerulli, C-E-R-U-L-L-I. You can read more about his work at his website, tovarcerulli.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Tovar Cerulli. Recall an experience with an animal, wild or domestic, from your childhood or teen years. Write the scene as you recall it, describing what occurred. Read your own description and consider, are there additional layers of thought or feeling that are relevant? And do you want to work any of these into the scene? And then you can optionally do a second round where you recall a more recent experience with an animal and write and consider that scene, and then write about what similarities or differences exist that you notice between the two scenes. So good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. As a reminder, if you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or you'd like to send me a writing prompt to possibly use in a future show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I use your prompt, I will credit you for it. And then please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.